Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
There are plenty of people in the world who are eager to throw their ideas and opinions at you, who want to tell you what you should care about, what you should believe, what you should think, and how you should live your life. But this is not that. Instead, the purpose of the mirror is to take you on a journey inside your own mind, to let you explore the inner world of your own thought processes. The mirror is not about what facts you know or how smart you are. It's about exploring what you believe, how you see the world, and why. An interactive process where the way you answer certain questions determines where you will go and what you will discover next. In here, you are the scientist and the subject. You are the doctor and the patient. In here, you will decide what is true and what is false, what is right and what is wrong. But be warned, while digging into the inner workings of your own thoughts, you may discover things you didn't know were there, things that may make you uncertain and uncomfortable. So the first, and perhaps the most important question, is this. If, for whatever reason, you weren't seeing the world as it really is, if certain misunderstandings and false assumptions were causing you to think things and do things which go against what you really believe in and who you really are, would you want to know about it?
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is December 13th, 2015. I'm so excited to welcome Larkin Rose back to the show. But before we do that, did you hear the date? December 13th, 2015. Merry Christmas. I'm going to say it. You know, it was just like a couple weeks ago, I was recording a Thanksgiving show, and I said, oh, you know, get ready. There's a lot of BS coming with this Christmas. And a lot of you have been listening for a while. You know my attitudes. I'm like, hey, Santa, get out of here. You know, who are you kidding? Who do you think you're fooling at this point? Or Scram, Elf on the Shelf. Have parents gone nuts? Have you seen this? If you don't know what that is, and you adhere either just in principle or in practice to the parenting philosophy that we discuss on School Sucks, and you don't know what this thing is, go to schoolsucksproject.com, search Elf on the Shelf. You are going to go bananas. You are really not going to react well to this, and I look forward to your mail about it if you need to send it. We've covered it in... gosh, two or three shows at this point. I needed the year off from Elf on the Shelf, if you don't mind. So yeah, I got kind of a sour, shitty attitude towards Christmas generally. I'll tell you what, though. You go out there, you go into a store, you hear those old Christmas songs play, you drive by all of these houses where people have attached these beautiful, twinkling Christmas lights to their roofs, with industrial staplers. And I don't know what it does for you, but for me, I just transform. My cold heart just melts in the warmth of the holiday spirit. And I'm ready. I'm ready for Christmas. I'm ready to shop. Oh, by the way, if you're shopping on Amazon, schoolsucksproject.com, and enter through our portal. It's right on the front page of the website. And then we get a little kickback. Like, let's spread the holiday cheer. You know what I mean? Like I'm doing right now. This is cheer that I'm spreading. So I don't know. This year, I'm excited about Christmas. And I'm excited about today's show. Bang, that's called a segue. I got Larkin Rose. You know, it was a couple weeks ago, I think, it was brought to my attention that Larkin is working on a new project called The Mirror. It's an interactive self-teaching tool. It's completely free. It's probably going to be online within the next few months. Larkin is working away on this like crazy right now. So I watched the trailer. I watched a video about it. And then I reached out to Larkin. We hadn't talked in over a year. It's always a great thing to do, to have a conversation with Larkin Rose and record it and share it with you after it's been, you know, sufficiently edited, of course. And it turns out Larkin is retired from speaking and doing interviews. He, of course, made an exception for us. We are one of the best shows. He said, Brett, I don't think I can afford not to do that. You know, and in all seriousness, I'm very, very grateful for Larkin taking time out of his busy schedule to sit down with us. I will say this lines up perfectly with what we do at schoolsucksproject.com. I offered him some help. I wanted to make the group available to him. You know, if he ever needs to bounce ideas off a bunch of people or get feedback, I'm sure a bunch of you would be willing to interact with Larkin and help him out with his project. And when this is done, I think it's going to be people like us who have the job of giving it to people who need it but don't know they need it. And I'm not trying to be really cryptic or turn this into a riddle. I mean, all this will be explained in the show today. So let's get to it. This is my conversation with Larkin Rose, and I hope everyone, sincerely, I hope everyone is having a beautiful holiday season. I know it doesn't really like feel like Christmas here in the Northeast. It was 55 degrees yesterday, and some people are pretty alarmed about that. They're running around saying, it shouldn't be this warm. And, you know, I'm a little concerned about it, too. And I'm starting to wonder if what we're experiencing here in New Hampshire might be the residual effects of me crushing up so many styrofoam cups when I was a boy. And they told me not to do it. You know, I thought they were just being alarmists, but maybe they were right, and maybe this is me reaping what I sow. They warned me and all of the other irresponsible children who would stomp on styrofoam cups that were so ubiquitous in the 80s. Every cup was made out of styrofoam, it seemed. We would crush them, you know, as kids, and they said, that's going to make a hole in the ozone layer. And I only grew up like 30 miles east of where I live right now, so that hole in the ozone layer would be pretty much directly above this area when you consider where most of the styrofoam cup crushing I was doing took place. And I regret that, and I'm sorry to the people in this area who were really hoping that there would be a beautiful blanket of white Christmas snow right now. If people come forward with more warnings about the environment in the future, I'll try to take them more seriously, you know? So yeah, anyway, here's my conversation with Larkin Rose. Thanks for listening, everybody. May all your Christmases be white, or, you know, whatever color you prefer. I don't even care. Happy holidays, I think is what I'm trying to say. And just to get a running start here, I'm going to play you some audio. This is an excerpt of a TEDx talk, Dr. Derek Cabrera, How Thinking Works. We are going to be exploring Dr. Cabrera's work in greater detail on the show in the near future. Please excuse the unchecked premises in what you're about to hear. I think this is a useful clip. Dr. Derek Cabrera is an internationally recognized expert in metacognition, in parentheses, thinking about thinking, epistemology, in parentheses, the study of knowledge, human and organizational learning, and education. He completed his PhD in postdoctoral studies at Cornell University and served as faculty at Cornell and researcher at the Santa Fe Institute. Here we go.
And I think of the faculty of this country, and myself included, as being sort of from the future. We get the kids when they're done with the K-12 system, we get them. So in a way, we come from the future with a message. And that message is, the miracle didn't happen. Our college students can't think. We don't need a miracle. What we need is a method. We need the ability to teach thinking through a method in our schools alongside the lessons. There are four universal thinking skills that research shows are happening and that we can use to teach kids how to think. If we teach these skills, they lead to those six types of thinking I talked about: critical thinking, creative thinking, interdisciplinary and scientific thinking, and even pro-social and emotional development. The first thing that we can do to get kids thinking again is to teach them to make distinctions between ideas and objects and things. What does it mean to make a distinction? What we mean is to define our terms. But we don't just want to define the terms. We want kids to learn to increasingly over time create more sophisticated, more nuanced distinctions. When a student takes something and makes a distinction, they're actually bringing something into existence. And in doing that, we get a deeper understanding of things. We have more clarity of thought, and in turn, more clarity of communication. The second thing we can do to get kids thinking again is to teach them to look at the parts and the wholes that make up systems. Every part is a whole. and every whole is a part. That is universal. It's often said in science that there are really, fundamentally, just two kinds of scientists. There's splitters and there's lumpers. Splitters are the scientists who sort of break things down into parts and then break those parts into parts and so on and so on. And lumpers take all the parts and they put them back together again. What we need to do is create a new generation of young students who can split and lump easily. They can construct new ideas and they can deconstruct old ideas or existing ideas. The third thing we can do to get thinking back into the classroom is to recognize relationships, to teach our children to recognize relationships between and among ideas. In our schools today, we almost teach the lack of relationships or disconnection. We teach in departments, in courses, in subject areas, and in disciplines. And yet we know that the world is a very interconnected place. We need to get our kids seeing more of these connections, more of these relationships. The fourth thing that we can do to get our kids thinking again is to take multiple perspectives. Everything looks different when you take a new perspective. And when we teach perspective taking, there are things that are correlated with teaching perspective taking that we all want. Increased empathy, increased compassion, increased pro-social thinking and emotional development. Even things like increased skills of negotiation and conflict resolution and spatial reasoning. Perspectives are wildly important. These four skills, distinctions, systems, relationships, and perspectives, what I call DSRP, will get kids thinking again. And they combine in lots of different ways to create an ecology of thoughts that are very, very complex. They're actually universal to the process of thinking. And they're universal to that process of taking information and structuring it and turning it into some kind of knowledge that we can use. Our kids are flooded with information. We're all flooded with information in this day and age. There's information coming at us from all directions. The number one thing we can do for our children is give them the tools to structure that information in meaningful ways so that they can do something with it. And believe me, if we don't teach them to think, there are plenty of people who will happily think for them. In our Declaration of Independence, it says that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. I have a question for you. What is the meaning of that consent if the governed are not thinking?
I just wanted to review for people who might be new. Your last appearance on the show was in September of 2012. And we included you in our Logic series covering a book that you wrote that was fairly new at the time with The Most Dangerous Superstition. And for those who are unfamiliar, this is from Larkin's website. I'm just going to read a description of the book. When someone looks out at the world and sees all the manner of suffering and injustice stretching back for thousands of years and continuing today, he invariably blames such problems on someone else's hatred, greed, or stupidity. Rarely will anyone consider the possibility that his own belief system is the cause of pain and suffering he sees around him. But in most cases, it is. The root cause of almost all society's ills, the main cause of inhumanity to man, is neither malice nor negligence, but a mere superstition. An unquestioned assumption which has been accepted on faith by nearly everyone, of all ages, races, religions, education, and income levels. If people were to recognize that one belief for what it is, an utterly irrational, self-contradictory, and horribly destructive myth, most of the violence, oppression, and injustice in the world would cease. But that will happen only when people dare to honestly and objectively re-examine their belief systems. The Most Dangerous Superstition exposes the myth for what it is, showing how nearly everyone, as a result of one particular unquestioned assumption, is directly contributing to violence and oppression without even realizing it. If you imagine yourself to be a compassionate, peace-loving, civilized human being, you must read this book. So we had you on. We talked about the book extensively. We opened the phones, if you remember. And we had one caller. The topic was the Constitution. I actually looked it up. the title of the show. I got three shows out of one Skype call with you back in September 2012. But this last one, it was called A Goddamn Piece of Paper, Larkin Rose versus a Collar. So that kind of sets the – people can imagine the tone that we had in the show. It was very aggressive. There were lots of people talking over each other. I remember when I edited it, I was like, oh, my God, this is almost too chaotic. I had to cut out some parts where four people were talking at once because it wasn't just me, you, and the caller. I also had a co-host. He had just read your book. He had plenty to say about it. So it was a mess. But we've talked a lot about – being successful in one-on-one conversations with people, right? When it comes to spreading the message of liberty. But kind of an impractical approach when there's 7 billion people on the planet and almost none of them embrace this philosophy. So then there's the question of what to do about it. And that brings us to this new project that you're working on. It's called The Mirror. I'm going to include the audio from the trailer in the podcast. What is The Mirror? And why is it being created?
Well, the why is just what you said. You know, in between, I've been an anarchist for almost 20 years now. And having talked one-on-one or one-on-10 or one-on-100 or whatever,
right,
with statists constantly and studying the way they think and the way they respond, you know, it occurred to me that it doesn't matter how, you know, persuasive I am or whatever, the numbers are just don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I always assumed, well, you know, we can make videos and we can make books and this and that and the other stuff. And there's a bunch of great stuff out there that will persuade the people who want to go out of their way to learn stuff, who are already open-minded. But you can't really mass produce the actual interactive, direct personal discussions that are most effective. I always assumed, because how on earth would you do that? Well, The Mirror, not only is that, not only is it a way to mass produce an interactive discussion, not just a lecture, not just sit there and shut up while I tell you what I think, but actually it's all focused on questioning them to get the user to think about what he believes, what he advocates, what his actual moral code is. But it's interactive, so it's different for every person who does it, and 7 billion people can do it at the same time, and they'll all have different experiences. And for I don't know how many years, I assumed that's totally impossible. It's too complicated. But then I came to the realization it actually is pretty much a formula. It sort of came from me starting to write a manual for for lines of questioning to use on status so other people could learn to do it and just sort of passively do the intellectual Aikido thing where you just ask them what they believe and you lead them up to their own contradictions. And then I realized you actually could make an animated thing that does this for you. It's ridiculously complicated to make because it has to be able to account for any answer they can give and go in whatever direction they want it to go in. But I finally came to the conclusion it actually can be done, and now I'm in the process of doing it.
So there's things on the technical side, like basically building out flow charts and then getting somebody to narrate those flow charts, I'm sure, which is, yeah, you're right, a ridiculous process. But there's also the question of, like, we're talking here about a self-teaching tool. And for me, that was one of the reasons why I thought this lined up with what we do at School Sucks. There's also a certain involvement of educational psychology in this. Mm-hmm. So how did you prepare in terms of not just experience, which you've had plenty of, but also in research to actually build this interactive program?
A lot of it, you know, a thing I've said often is that over the last 20 years, the philosophical concept hasn't even been the main focus. I mean, that's when you understand self-ownership and non-aggression and that stuff in a voluntary society, it's not very complicated. Like, you can explain it in 5 minutes. The problem is the other person isn't likely to listen. So 2% of the challenge is understanding the philosophy. 98% of the challenge is understanding the weird psychological things that people do in order to avoid questioning their paradigms.
Yeah.
And that was the entire challenge of figuring out how to make The Mirror, is how do you – you know, navigate through the minefield of the human psyche that does all these weird things as soon as it's uncomfortable with the new idea. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen it a million times and I've seen it a million times. Pretty much everybody who's a voluntarist has seen it over and over again, where you talk to somebody And their response is just so out in left field. It's like, how did your response have anything to do with what I just said or just asked?
Right.
And so it's been a sort of accidental study for me of how the human brain freaks out and runs away from thinking about stuff. And then how do you make it not do that? How do you actually get an idea to the part of their brain that is capable of thinking about it without all this emotional, you know, fear-based, irrational garbage making them explode and run the other way?
And yeah.
So the entire script and the appearance of it and the tone of voice of the narrator, the wording of every single question, it's all made to be totally passive and gentle. It's never judgmental. It's never argumentative. I think it's actually going to be far better than a one-on-one discussion, because even when you're talking with one other person, if you know they have a fundamentally different view of reality or advocate something different than you, you're going to sort of automatically be on the defensive, like this is a combat.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that context is really important here, right? Because you might be a person might the thought would occur to somebody that it's the question that you asked at the end of the video. If the way you see things is not consistent with the way things really are, would you want to know? Well, it's funny that in the context of these discussions where there's a lot at stake politically, and I've said before that it seems like there's essentially this subtext in political discussions, which is like, we're trying to decide whose will be imposed on the other person. If you're just talking about the traditional left and right, or, you know, if you're a libertarian arguing with somebody, it's even like there's more at stake. Like, wait a minute, my will is not going to get imposed in your world. So there are things in these discussions like time sensitivity and fear of being wrong and fear of being judged, as you said, that really disrupt a person's ability to realize that they want to live consistently with what exists, mm-hmm. right? Because the emotional volume is turned up so loud that adherence to reality becomes somehow not a top priority anymore.
Right. And the goal of this thing is not, and it even basically says this early on, it's not to take some outside opinion and smash it into the head of the user. It's just to let the user examine his own thought processes and sort out anything that's in there that he didn't know about, and then he gets to decide what to do about it. And the only reason that works is that you can't believe in an authoritarian ruling class without having contradictions in your head.
Right.
So it isn't a matter of, you know, I want to hit them over the head with my moral code and priorities until they agree with me. It's just a matter of helping them sort out the contradictions. Because that's the only reason I'm an anarchist, is because I kept looking at my philosophy and going, well, those things don't match. One of them's got to go, and throwing them out, until I got to the point of realizing, wow, I can't describe a legitimate government. Oh, well. Mm-hmm. Like, it was accidental. And to help people, it's really just about, you know, as much as I want everyone to agree with me, it's really just about helping people all the way be consistent with who they are deep down inside. And taking, because the vast majority of people already generally grasp and abide by the non-aggression principle, even if they've never heard that phrase in their life.
Yeah, on a day-to-day practical basis, sure.
Right. But on top of that, they've been taught this mythology that says, well, those people over there with badges and fancy titles and big buildings, they have an exemption. So it's a superstition on top of an otherwise, you know, decent moral code. So you don't have to convince people to be good. You just have to take that mangled superstition off the top that's getting in the way of them being what they think they should be.
Well, yeah, it's also the superstition being used to somehow enforce the moral code. Like basically, while overlooking that the belief in the superstition is a violation of that.
Right, right. And even in, you know, one thing the mirror does a little later on is this thing I used to do in an event I called Escaping the Myth, mm-hmm. where if you imagine, all right, you're on an island with 100 people you don't know, you know, plenty of resources, but you're stuck there and you're sort of starting from scratch. And then you ask people how they would want to interact, how they would organize things, how they would suggest things be done. Almost everybody talks as a libertarian or an anarchist. None of them says, well, the first thing we need is somebody who gets to boss us around and hurt us if we disobey. Nobody says that.
Right.
Surprisingly. So even the thing of enforcing their moral code on others is not something they actually believe in, except by way of this magical, mystical thing called authority. So it's still an exemption to what they really believe in, that this political indoctrination is stuck in their heads. And this, you know, it's one of many things that the mirror just sort of walks them up to and then lets them decide, well, are we going to have a world where it's a contest to see whose priorities get violently imposed on everybody else? Or are you okay with, you know, if somebody isn't attacking you, leave them in freedom and they'll leave you in freedom, which is what almost everybody wants outside of political discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've basically covered the problem being addressed here, which is essentially the acceptance of authoritarianism, right?
Right.
That's
right.
What it boils down to. We've talked a little bit about the practical approach or the logical approach, just not working with people in those one-on-one settings. I mean, they might even work for a while. This is something that we're going to talk about. Like, you might walk away from a discussion basically thinking that you made some progress until you see them again. And you're like, oh, what happened? But we'll get. I have a phrase for that. We could talk about that in a little more detail. There is definitely something getting in their way. We can cover that in a little more detail. But what is the buy-in for somebody to sit down with the mirror and start using it? You know, I think it takes a pretty curious mind, right?
Right. That's the challenge, is getting it in front of the people who don't go out of their way to learn new things. And I think for that, it has to be visually engaging enough that people, you know, as soon as they start, it carries their interest and it makes them want to keep going. The whole thing is computer animated. It's all in a computer generated world with 3D graphics and stuff. And I'm programming all that in a thing called Blender, a program called Blender. So it has to stay interesting enough. I mean, it's almost like the setting of a video game or something, in that it's 3D graphics and stuff instead of, you know, some guy like me standing in front of a camera yammering at it for 20 minutes.
Exactly. There's plenty of that.
Right. There's no shortage of that around. And a thing that, again, this is all about psychology, a thing that automatically forces somebody to engage is asking them a question. I mean, if you walk up to somebody and you lecture them in their face, and I can't count how many libertarians I've seen do this to somebody who isn't even paying attention. They're just looking for the first excuse to run out the door.
Sure.
But if you walk up to somebody and you ask them a question, they can't not be engaged. Even if they didn't pay attention and don't really know what's going on yet, how many times do you walk up to somebody and ask them a question and they just don't respond? They just stand there. People don't do that. And the moment they hear a question, they think, I have to say something. Like, they can't help but have their brain at least put in the effort to try to think of what to say about that.
Right.
So the whole process is question and answer all the way through. The entire, there's no explanation. There's no lecture. The entire process is asking questions. And so they sort of can't not be engaged. And it uses little visual tricks to make things memorable and all sorts of stuff like that. But because it's a discussion in this weird 3D abstract colorful world, and because they have to be involved because, you know, there's constantly a new question, and because the questions are designed to keep them interested and go, hey, that's sort of interesting, that it doesn't feel like, oh, incidentally, they make it almost all the way through before there's any mention of government or authority or law or any of that.
Interesting.
Because that is just the terms that are applied to this stupid superstition that's stuck on top of what they really believe in. So it basically lays the whole foundation of what they really believe in, what they think the world should be, who they are, what they care about. And none of that requires political terminology. Once they've given all their answers of how they think things should be, then it finally gets to the political stuff and compares their answers to political beliefs. And then they start to see the contradictions and go, oh yeah, I said that. Is there, or do you want to make an exception for, like, it's not okay to steal somebody's money to buy something for his own good? Like, if they agreed to something like that before, and then it comes to taxation, say, okay, well, do you want to change your answer now or what?
Interesting. So when we talk about the actual user experience here, there's really no way to estimate the amount of time that it would take someone to go to start from start to finish. And you said there is definitely a finish. Now, a person could wind up thinking about one question or one problem for like an hour if they wanted to, which has incredible benefits in, right. in self-consciousness and self-awareness, essentially. Because when we're having actual discussions with people, even if they're not particularly hostile, there's times where, you know, the other person is just like in their head, they say, well, say something stupid so you don't look like an idiot. I mean, that's basically it. They'll say anything to, like, silence is losing.
Right.
In a lot
right.
of these discussions. So people have, and I've, you know, I've caught myself definitely doing it in the past as well, even once I thought I had a fairly firm grasp of these ideas. Like, if you get to a 1-1000, 2-1000 count, and you're not blurting out the next thing in that argument, you're starting to look like the loser. So
right.
this is a way around that. And it sounds like the only way to actually finish here is to remove all contradictions, to be consistent.
Right. And the thing is, you're allowed to give stupid answers. You're allowed to cling to your stupid answers. And all it does, the program never says, well, then you're just a total idiot, get lost.
Mm-hmm.
All it does is leave them presented with their own answers and their own contradictions. And it doesn't even say this is a contradiction. It just says, okay, is this where you want to end? And so ultimately, like, I think a lot of people will sort of get to that point and say, yeah, that's close enough. And then it'll rattle around in their head, and then they'll want to come back and say, well, what about this thing? And move on a little bit. But yeah, you never get all the way done until those contradictions aren't staring you in the face. There's so much about it that's better than a one-on-one discussion. One, like you just said, if somebody asks you a question, almost nobody will sit there in, you know, for 30 seconds of silence thinking about it, even though that's what everybody should do.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't know the answer in 2 seconds, you should sit there and think about it for a while, but nobody wants to do that. Well, if it's only a computer, you know, and in front of you, and it tells you, you can take your time, you can leave and come back whenever you want, and then there is none of that pressure, and there's none of the – it's not adversarial. It's not judgmental. There's no rush. There's no time limit. There's no – you know, nobody's even knowing that it's you answering the question, so you can take forever. You can try one. You can even back up and change your answers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just all the way none of the things that sort of psychologically push people into being – in a hurry and defensive and stupid and yeah, just I got to blurt out something. And then, you know how that goes. If somebody blurts out an answer, they know it was stupid, but they can't just say, never mind, that was stupid. They have to cling to it and defend something really stupid. And this even lets them back out of that. If they made an answer and later go, yeah, that was kind of dumb. Can I try a different one? Yeah. And there's no judgment. It's not, haha, I got you, I win. It's
yeah.
not that tone at all. It really is, because really the only way people learn is if they want to discover something for themselves. It isn't someone else smashing it into their heads.
Right.
So all this does is lay it out in front of them and say, hey, if you want to study your own brain, your own thought processes, here's a tool to do it. But you're the judge.
Yeah.
It's up to you.
Yeah. Having reason and morality on your side really doesn't matter if it's not transmittable to others, you know.
Right.
And for a long time, I think I believed that I just wasn't being a good transmitter. But you also need ready receivers. And I think that in this process that you're describing, one of the biggest benefits, and we've touched on this, but I just want to reiterate it, is that it allows people to pay attention to their own thought process, mm-hmm. right? Which is how learning takes place. That's metacognition. And just to go back to what I call the Groundhog Day effect. Have you ever seen the movie Groundhog Day?
Yeah.
Bill Murray, he wakes up, and because he didn't do something right the day before, he has to replay the same day. So I feel like I've had the same political, philosophical, economic, education-related argument with some people dozens and dozens of times. You know, mm-hmm. If I had invested those hours with that one person into this podcast, obviously there would have been a much greater effect and a much greater product. So you say in the video that you just spent 3 hours wearing somebody down. I mean, that's essentially what it is a lot of the time. You're wearing somebody down. while thousands of statists were born, you know, while you were doing it. So a lot of times, though, that one person that you're talking to is going to revert back to their comfort zone. They're going to retreat to their comfort zone. And the only reason they went along with you, which was basically a submittal, is because of the psychological pressures that that situation created. Mm-hmm. So I love this idea that this program alleviates that pressure, but I'd like an example. So like if I sat down with this program and I'm a curious young mind, what do I encounter? What would be something that I would ask? I could even give, you know, a mock response and you could, you know, take me in a new direction. I'd be interested in learning a little bit more about how it actually works.
Right. It's there are a zillion examples, but I'll use the one that most of us already know. The thing about, can you delegate to somebody else a right you don't have? And can several people delegate a right they don't have? And so in the mirror, we'll actually show a visual representation. The main tour actually happens in a sort of a 3D model of the human mind, mm-hmm. Not the brain, because that's just an ugly mess, but with different things that represent different parts of how our minds work. But then it will bring up a little screen that shows visuals of, so it'll show like a stick man-y version, but in 3D, so it looks cooler. Like if three people want to have pizza for lunch and one person wants to have Chinese for lunch, do the three get to force the fourth person to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And almost everybody says, no, that's dumb. You know, if he decides to go in on it, that's fine. And the reason for the visuals is we remember things way better when we see something. If something's a written word or people hear it in language, they're usually pretty vague 5 minutes later about what they just discussed. But if you give them a visual thing to stick to, then that's way more likely to stay in there.
Yeah, it's become more true. It became much more the case even during my educational career, which lasted from about, you know, as a teacher or tutor, roughly 2002 to 2012. Because of the bombardment with audio video stimulation that didn't exist when you and I were young. I mean, we had television and music, but that was it. And if you watch like kids cartoons today, it looks like they were made by people on crack.
Yeah.
Like just the animation, the number of sound effects, the number of cuts. The cuts are just like, you know, multiple cuts per second, flashes, stupid dialogue. So a lot of the target audience for something like this, I hate to say it, but they might not even be able to, considering the encounter with ideas that are so uncomfortable, like in something like The Most Dangerous Superstition, in the written form, that might not even be accessible to a lot of people who are not low IQ, but just don't have the attention span or the intellectual or emotional endurance to make it through something like that. So using a tool like this, whether you want to say it's sad or not, is where we're at today as far as effectively reaching young people, largely because of the ways young brains are changing in response to this bombardment of stimuli.
Right. And that's, you know, I hear so many people say, these people can't be persuaded. And often that means they can't be persuaded by what you tried so far.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have to keep in mind the brains that we're trying to get to and what they're used to and what they're capable of and what they're not capable of and what's familiar and how they're going to respond to different things. Because you can have some loudmouth doing a great job of explaining some philosophical concept, and for most of the public, it won't ever get into the brain because of the way their brains work. And it isn't because you didn't explain it well enough or it wasn't rational enough. It's because that's like way down the list on whether something's persuasive or not, is whether it actually makes sense. Unfortunately, you know, I'd love it if we were a race of creatures that actually was rational and had our conclusions based on evidence and logic. But mostly it's just weird psychological stuff. And we have to account for that if we want to be successful. So this does that. It's funny you mentioned that the constant cuts, there are no cuts in the mirror. It is one shot all the way through, no matter which direction you go, which can only be done in computer animation, because you can't with a real camera go two ways after one scene. Well, you can in computer animation. Now there's lots of things going on and things appear and screens come up, and so there's plenty to keep their attention and make it visually interesting. But it isn't the distracting, flashy, confusing thing. It's you know where you are and you're where you are the whole time, and you fly around. You go to different places, but it's one shot the whole time, which I think feels a lot more like, all right, I'm in this real place. Because in the real world, your perspective doesn't suddenly change every 2 seconds.
Right.
You're looking from a different angle. But it has, you know, all the colorful visuals and sound effects and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, it's engaging. So just something you said a minute ago about user experience, just it prompted the question in me, how much have you studied psychology or emotional intelligence, and how necessary was that in the creation of this?
Most of my study was accidental by talking to statists, and then afterwards I've read various stuff about it to try to understand why on earth do people respond that way. And then there are various studies and books that talk about here are the weird things our brains do. So a bunch of it was sort of in the field by arguing with thousands of statists one at a time, and then reading about stuff after the fact to add to that and to get a better understanding of why our brains do the weird things they do. And that, I think, to make something like The Mirror, I think I sort of had to have both.
Yeah.
Is the direct, you know, watching statists make the weirdest responses imaginable, and then trying to sort of reverse engineer their brain, like what in their head makes them say that in response to this, that made no sense. But we have to figure out why they did it if we want them to not do that. If we want to, okay, the way it was worded, the setting, the all these things that made their brain freak out and do something emotional and irrational, we have to have a message or a way to spread the message that doesn't make them do that. Because it doesn't matter how right you are. If somebody brain freaks out and says, what about the roads, and jumps out a window?
Yeah.
It didn't work. Doesn't matter if you were right, it didn't work. And we've, you know, these concepts have been explained for hundreds of years in the most brilliant way you can imagine, and the vast majority of people have never heard about them and haven't adopted them. So it isn't just a matter of understanding it, it's a matter of how do you get the other people to understand it? And that's 99% psychology. And, you know, the philosophy is just this tiny little obvious simple part of it.
Yeah, you're already doing it. By and large. Yeah. Anything noteworthy that you read on the subject of psychology?
I don't know. Mostly it was a bunch of, you know, random articles about a lot of studies on how people respond to things like the Solomon Ash experiments, with the different length lines, and you have 10 people, 9 of them are actors, and the 9 will give an obviously wrong response. And then they watch how often the 10th person will give what he knows is a wrong response just because the other 9 people, you know, did it. And a bunch of like that sort of study, articles about that kind of study to see why people are so weird. why all the things that make them be totally irrational, and then the things that make them be rational again. And of course, the Milgram experiments was a huge one. In study, I mean, there's so many levels of psychology that gets into. And for me, it's, you know, it can be kind of be a depressing thing of, wow, people are just going to idiotically obey authority and be evil if it tells them to be. But there's a lot in there to learn how to make that not happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it really comes down to, you know, people trying to get emotional needs met. We have simpler brains that people are often unaware of, who don't have, you know, much of a background in neurology, that are basically, you know, striving for survival. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times there can be these emotional interferences. It's like, shit, I might not survive. And, you know, if you're lucky, if that can be calmed, you can get to the prefrontal cortex. There's this the metaphor of the elephant and the rider. Have you ever heard that?
I don't think so.
So I don't know where this idea originated. I have a feeling it's Buddhist, but you have an elephant and a person riding it, you know, and the elephant is the emotional world, and the person riding it, who's controlling it or trying to control it, if it's calm, is the rational mind, mm-hmm. right? So you don't really have a chance to deal with the rider in a safe way if you don't have a calm and under control elephant.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. You need a tranquilizer gun for that damn elephant.
Right, right. But most of the time, you know, we're you know, when I started at the beginning, I was, you know, so angry. That was part of it. And so excited and so self-righteous that I would just go up to the rider. I would say hi to the rider and then just throw firecrackers at the elephant's feet, you know, and I never get anywhere. Mm-hmm. So learning that. And it also reminds, there's a painting that hangs in my wall that was inspired by the Viktor Frankl quote, between stimulus and response. Are you familiar with that one?
It sounds vaguely familiar.
Paraphrased, between stimulus and response. And if I just pause for a minute and you think about the way, and you can certainly see this playing out in current events or political rhetoric, stimulus response, you know, input output. That's what most people are doing.
Right.
And they're not really processing their inputs. They're not really recognizing, as Viktor Frankl says, between stimulus and response, there is a space, you know, and in that space lies an opportunity to think about how you'll respond.
Mm-hmm.
And in that response lies your growth and your freedom.
Right.
So if that space is very narrow and people just jump stimulus, response, like we see so often, no growth happens and there's no freedom, you know, or there's a dwindling of the amount of, you know, personal and political freedom that people have. So, you know, what we try to do on my show is basically widen that space as much as we can. What can go in it? What intellectual tools can go in that space? What emotional tools can go in that space? What communication tools are useful in that space? So it sounds like giving people an opportunity to encounter difficult ideas and material, but in a way that's not stressful, that's not rushed, has a tremendous benefit. You know, it also brings up the idea of metacognition. I asked you about this before the show. You said you were vaguely familiar. For the people in the audience who aren't, this is a definition from Educational Leadership, which is a scholarly journal, from an article called The Nature and Nurture of the Self-Directed Learner. Metacognition refers to the awareness of one's own knowledge, what one does and doesn't know, and one's ability to understand, control, and manipulate one's own cognitive processes. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's it's funny because that's exactly what the mirror is. The reason it's called the mirror is this is you looking at yourself. It's mm-hmm. not somebody else looking at you and calling you names. And because it takes place in this thing that I refer to as Brain City, it's not called that in the actual thing, but it represents the human mind. It's all about looking into your own head and seeing what's going on there with that person. Like it says in the introduction, the user is the doctor and the patient and the scientist and the subject. Like, they're the only one there. It's just a way to let them study, you know, use their brain to study their own brain to see what's going on, because that immediately makes it less scary. It you know, tells the elephant you can go have a nap because there's no danger here. There's no judgment. There's no conflict. This is just you tinkering around in your brain and seeing what's going on in there. And you get to decide what to do about whatever you find. It's not like, uh-oh, I was found with this contradiction. Now somebody's going to beat me up. Now you can keep your contradiction if you feel like it, or if that makes you uncomfortable, you can decide to do away with it. But yeah, it's totally self-examination. It's just sort of a guided tour version of self-examination to help people know where to look, and then they decide what to do about it.
Yeah, and I like the idea of the elephant coming along, but very pacified and just wants to eat peanuts and kind of observe along with you, because the two are really inextricable, you know, like the emotional world is really intertwined with the logical processes, you know. I mean, I used to be really critical of people who would respond to George Bush or Barack Obama and these emotional ways, like, oh, if you're being emotional, you can't be logical. But if you shut off the emotion, or you can view the world in a coldly logical way, like, I don't even understand really what the point of freedom would be.
Yeah.
You know, personal freedom has, you know, huge emotional rewards.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that it is in many ways an emotional pursuit. So, right. Yeah, the elephant is definitely always there. And go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say it's actually the representation, and you can see this in the trailer. The camera sort of flies through this random abstract thing inside this brain. It doesn't explain what anything is at that point. At that point, it's just abstract weirdness. But a lot of the focus at the beginning is the perceptions, which is represented by a green, transparent, crystally thing in the middle. And then you have the emotions, which affect that, and the thought process, which affect that, and your memory, which affects that, and your subconscious, which affects that. Each thing in that weird abstract thing represents something. And then as the mirror progresses, the user gets to examine one at a time, and here's how your emotions affect your perceptions, with them giving the examples, because it will ask them questions about their own experiences and what they believe, and which of these pictures gives you a positive general feeling, and which gives you a negative general feeling, and it's, yeah, we don't need to shut down any pieces of it. We just need to see how they all work together and make sure that what comes out the other end isn't stupid and destructive. And that's actually an example it uses very early on. It uses the sort of silly example of, imagine some foreigner has no idea what's going on, who walks into a magic show and he thinks he sees someone sawing a lady in half. Well, from his perception, what's he going to do? He's going to hopefully run up there and try to stop the magician.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, someone in the audience sees that happening. It's going, wow, some maniac is attacking the magician. I got to go stop them.
Right.
The entire problem is misperception of reality. There's no malice there. Nobody's being stupid. Nobody's being immoral. Based on their own view of what's going on, everybody's actions are perfectly fine, and you have a violent conflict.
Right.
And that demonstrates that the perception is the thing that matters. So it basically, uses that as an example and then asks the user, if your perceptions were making you accidentally harm somebody who shouldn't be harmed, would you want to know about it? And then leads into the study of things that may be doing that, things that may be, their perception of what's going on is making them act against their actual moral code, their actual values, by doing destructive stuff.
Yeah.
And so, just all the pieces work together, and we don't need to throw any out. We just need to not be violent and stupid because we don't understand what's going on.
Absolutely. And when it comes to the user interface with the mirror, this is one of the things that I've been thinking about throughout our entire discussion. We're talking about an active learning process, right? And the way I've thought about it and talked about it before is that in an active learning process, and this kind of relates to, you ever heard of Mortimer Adler and How to Read a Book? Basically talks about how the active engagement with literature or nonfiction and understanding purpose and having goal, that kind of an approach. Well, I mean, it's also true with the learning process itself. So usually there's a kind of planning phase where people might ask questions like, what prior knowledge do I have that will help me with this, which is really kind of unfortunate in a lot of political and philosophical discussions, because they're a lot of the time being encouraged to do a 180 on prior knowledge and run in the other direction.
Right.
Time sensitivity would also be something that would come up in the planning phase. Goals would come up in the planning phase. Most of what you've described here would happen in the second phase, which has a lot to do with self-monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, when you're done or when you're working towards the end of something, if it does have an end, some self-evaluation phase. How did
I
do? What did I learn? What has changed for me? What old ideas can be discarded? But let's talk about, as far as the user interface is concerned, the planning phase. When somebody sits down and opens this, what do they encounter? How is this process introduced to them?
The trailer for it is actually the beginning of it, which leads up to the first question of if you weren't seeing the world as it really is, would you want to know about it? If they say no, it backs up and says, well, then the mirror's not for you. That's the only time they ever get kicked out. It's if you say no, if I was wrong, I want to stay wrong. Okay, then get out. But if they say yes, then it goes into, it talks about how the two main categories are how they think the world is and how they think the world ought to be. And at first, it lays some groundwork just so they know the different elements we're talking about, and it'll ask them things about their their memories and their the things that and their beliefs that may affect their perceptions. Although it also points out, it doesn't matter why you have those beliefs. So it doesn't like challenge their religion. It doesn't, you know, demand that they justify themselves. But you're actually in the interface. You're in this little pod thing flying around in Brain City. And so you have like a control panel, and it brings up screens to ask you things, and it can plug into the different elements of the human brain, like your memories and your emotions and your instincts and your perceptions and your subconscious. And then it will, related to one of that, it will bring up a question with a little visual. One of the things it spends a bunch of time on is a virtual island. Like, okay, you're on this island with 100 other people, like I said, and then it asks them in this scenario, would you approve of this? You know, would you approve of, you know, these people want to make a signal fire. These people want to make a path to the top of the island, top of the mountain to make a signal fire. These people want to start building huts. And it starts with very basic stuff. Like, do you think people should be able to organize however they want? Or do you think somebody should be in charge and force everybody to do things one way? And almost everybody will say, no, you can do what you want and work together for organization. While showing it with little representations, but it intentionally, so it starts with really basic stuff where everybody goes, you know, it's like a normal quiz online. Well, that's easy. That's a little more questionable. That I might have to think about, to make it more challenging until you come up to the line where they have to pause and think for a while. Incidentally, they can always leave. If you click escape, it gives you a number, for when you come back, which will tell the computer all the answers you did before.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that a lot of the good that the mirror will do will happen when people aren't doing it. Like if they get to a point where they don't dare to answer and they're just thinking, I don't really know how to answer that. I'm going to walk away for a while. That's the self-reflection. That's where most of the progress happens. And they can either do it while sitting there looking at the screen, or they can go, you know, go mow their lawn.
Right.
Think
right.
About it while doing that. So it's, you know, it starts with basic stuff where people go, obviously, and then they start to get uncomfortable, not even uncomfortable, just they're not quite sure how to answer and have to think about it. And then it just leaves them there. And if they keep being confident, it keeps going through. But it's always in the form of multiple choice questions, because you can't, you know, short of building an artificial consciousness, which I don't quite know how to do.
It
has to be a flow chart with, you know, finite number of directions it can go. But it's always one question leads into the next one. And the goal being, you lay down the obvious part. Oh, and there's even things like early on, it will ask, you know, positive or negative. What's your just instinctive response to these images? Positive or negative or neutral?
Oh, interesting.
And it'll do things like a snake and woods and city and things that don't matter, but like a cop. And then later on.
So it's really just approach with confidence or fight or flight kind of responses to these things that you're getting?
Right. At that point, it's just sort of what's your general instinctive response. It isn't like think things out. So it's about, and it says it's not like there's a right or a wrong. It's just however your brain perceives these things as good and bad.
But it's as simple as thumbs up, thumbs down, basically, as far as what you're asking them for feedback. Okay. Gotcha.
Right. And then a different thing it does shortly after that is it says it'll list a bunch of phrases and say whether this has to you a good connotation or a bad connotation. And it has a bunch of things, and sprinkled in there are like obeying the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's collecting these answers while it's going along. And then later it will bring up the fact that, okay, before you had a positive, you know, connotation to obeying the law, as most people do. And then it gets into, you know, this is farther down the road, but like, do you think in another country, in another time, if there's some tyrant who passes a nasty law, do the people have an obligation to obey it, or is it actually good? Do you think it's good for them to disobey? And most people are comfortable with saying, yeah, they should disobey, when we're talking about a different country and a different time and a different ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
As it inches towards, what about today in your country with your ruling class? That's when their brakes start to jam on and they start to go, ooh, I might have to think about that. So it always nudges them up towards it, starting with the easy, obvious stuff. until they have to think about it. And either way, it doesn't say, haha, that's wrong.
Right.
It just says, you know, because everybody can think of an example where they say, well, if the law said that, I would disobey it. Okay. Well, what does that say about like your moral code versus authority, you know, as far as you're perceiving it? If you think you get to decide when to obey the law, what does that say about authority?
Right.
Ultimately, it says there's no such freaking thing. But it doesn't bluntly just blurt that out.
One of the things that's made me so excited about this when I started to understand what it actually was, I had this experience, maybe this was like 4 years ago, and I was tutoring this student. He went to a virtual online academy. So all his classes were just like modules that he worked through by himself, but he needed help with it. And I was his tutor. So one of the classes that we did together was called Government. And we go to the homepage for the course to look at like the syllabus and all that. And there's the picture of the instructor with Nancy Pelosi. So I say, great. I know how, because these instructors design the courses. So the first activity is called, it's like this interactive learning adventure called Do We Need Government? You remember the old like choose your own adventure books, right? That's what it is. So I don't want to say I manipulated it because I was tutoring, but this student had kind of like a very low level of interest in this anyway. And I was really just trying to help him get through the stuff so he could get a diploma and do the things that he actually wanted to do with his life. But he needed like money from his parents. And part of the condition was that he get a high school diploma. So I'm working through this choose your own adventure and I'm being as libertarian as I possibly can. I know I saw your picture with Nancy Pelosi. I know what you're up to. So I answer the questions carefully. I get to the end. You need government. So I go through again. I answer all the questions differently. You need government. I think I tried like 5 or 6 or 7 different combinations and everyone led to government. I was so frustrated. But then I was like, well, wait a minute. I'm the fool here, because if there was a way to go through this choose your own adventure, and this was like activity number 1.1, do we need government? Now, I'm the fool, because if there's a way to not need government through this activity, this poor woman wasted all of her time designing the other 12 modules for her, pro Nancy Pelosi government course. So that was my experience. That was the closest thing I had to a supposedly interactive political and philosophical self-examination to this. And it wasn't that. So I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all your information about this. Your website is larkinrose.com, correct?
Yep.
And what are you looking for as far as support or spreading the word with this project?
At this point, the main thing is just the more time I can spend on it, the faster it's going to get done. It's still going to be months more work. I mean, I've done a whole bunch on it, but it's just a matter of if I have to do other things to pay my bills, that leaves less time to work on this. There have been a couple people who gave me a bunch of money, so I have been able to work on it full time for I don't know how many months it's been. Really, it's that. And the beauty is there isn't, because Blender is a program I use and it's free, and I also use Reaper for the sound, which is free, and GIMP for the graphics, which is free. So there's sort of no expenses of actually making the thing. At the end, I think I even have somebody to volunteer to make it into the thing that actually, the actual app or the thing that plays on a website or whatever. That's the one thing I don't know how to do myself, but it's a fairly simple version of that. Other than that, there sort of aren't expenses, so it's just a matter of how much time I can put in it. There is the thing of flying the narrator out, which we just did again, to narrate another big chunk of the narration, which, as you can imagine, because it has to be able to go in any direction, if the user, for every hour of the user actually experiencing the thing, there may be 10 or 20 hours that we have to record and animate and do stuff. So it's a monumentally huge thing. But other than that, there aren't that many expenses. There's just, do I have to do other stuff for 8 hours a day? So it might light and water doesn't get turned off.
Yeah.
So it's, ultimately, especially if you can compare it to your average like animated movie, which has a budget of $7 zillion,
right?
It'll be a whole lot less than that. But it's just a matter of time and how much time I can spend on it. But it will get done. If it takes years or months or, you know, either way, I will finish the thing.
Do you have a group of people that you can bounce ideas off of?
Yeah, I have a few people. You know, I know a million people want input on the flow chart. Mm-hmm. And it would just turn into way too many chefs in the kitchen. But I do have people that I sort of a select team of people I run it by. For the wording and the approach and the appearance and all that sort of stuff, to study. And a lot of the study of that has been the responses that statists give to different things, like to watch the way their brains go in the wrong direction. It's like, okay, don't word it that way because mm-hmm, right. their brains go over there. But yeah, I do have people to run that stuff by.
Well, if it comes to questions of or just needing some feedback on things that relate to educational psychology or emotional intelligence, you know, we have a School Sucks Project group on Facebook. We gave up on forums like everybody did. And, you know, there's 1,500 very, very bright people in there. I'll add you to the group. And if you ever just, you know, want 20 responses to some question or some idea you want feedback on, I'll make that resource available to you. And I'd be happy to hear, you know, anything that I could do to help out with something like this, because I'm really excited to see, especially as time goes by, as we move into the future, how something like this can be implemented, how it can be embraced, and what the results are. I mean, I always think about my project as one person at a time. I mean, it's really the only way you can think about it. Before I even recorded the first podcast, I had abandoned the idea of, you know, reforming education or saving the schools or, you know, saving the masses from indoctrination. You know, I look out and I see things like Common Core. And I, you know, I just said this in the introduction to the last show. I fully accept the fact that most people are going to live their lives according to the script that was written for them by somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. So getting this into the hands of people who are enthusiastic about it and understand what it is and then can disseminate it to, you know, everybody who already knows why the mirror is useful knows 50 people who don't know. Right. Right. So right. I think it has a great potential benefit in that respect. So let us know how we can help. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Larkin. Are you going to be anywhere in the near future?
I mostly retired from interviews and public speaking. I'm making one exception to be at Anarchapulco this February down in Mexico to give a talk there, which actually relates to the mirror. It's not about the project, but it relates to it. But otherwise, I tell almost everybody, no, I'm not doing interviews because I'm working on this full time and a million distractions isn't exactly what I need. But
absolutely. Well, I hope this interview can be used somewhere down the road for some leverage. I hope we can help out. I hope I can help out. And, you know, just let us know if there's anything that we can do at schoolsucksproject.com, because this is right in our wheelhouse.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larkin.
Listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.